in hundreds of civil and criminal cases at every jurisdictional level. BBB officials coordinated with government investigators and prosecutors. BBB offices further responded to regular requests from governmental officials for assistance with enforcement efforts. During the early years of the New Deal, for instance, the Missouri Commissioner of Securities, resident in Jefferson City with no budget for investigative staff, pleaded with the St. Louis, Kansas City, and Springfield BBBs to forward intelligence about firms dealing in securities without licenses or about duly licensed dealers and brokers who may be adopting shady or questionable methods in the distribution of securities. After World War II, the Federal Housing Authority asked for BBB assistance in policing the submission of completion certificates by construction and home improvement companies, which were required for homeowners to receive FHA mortgages. The FHA's deputy commissioner went so far as to ask every office to establish a working relationship with the local BBB, because such close cooperation will serve as one means of maintaining a close watch over operations in your area. The post-World War II BBB network never enjoyed statutorily sanctioned authority like that of the NASD and Securities Regulation, though BBB leaders sometimes hoped for such formal delegation. As the head of Denver's BBB mused in an early 1960 memo, "Maybe we could dare to propose that BBBs be set up like Eric Johnston's operation in the movie industry, or NASD's operation in the securities business, the commissioner of baseball, etc." Such tentativeness suggests minimal confidence in achieving official grants of power. Nonetheless, the BBB's post-1945 activities meant that the line between public and private business regulation continued to blur, as efforts by public and private agencies shaded into one another, even without explicit legislative delegation. By the 1950s, the more established anti-fraud organizations, whether inside or outside the state, boasted numerous long-serving career professionals. These individuals had familiarity with marketplace deceptions, kept abreast of new variations, and knew how to conduct fraud investigations. The best of these careerists appreciated the challenges of navigating criminal and administrative enforcement actions and grasped the importance of sensible prosecutorial discretion given limited institutional resources. They also enjoyed strong personal relations with their peers and other agencies. Long tenure as a fraud fighter by itself did not guarantee legal savvy or implementation of effective enforcement techniques. The FTC developed a reputation for having bureaucratic deadwood, with timid staff attorneys cowed by the tendency of the pre-New Deal judiciary to overrule more expansive FTC actions. From the 1930s onward, many of the most powerful career attorneys owed appointment and promotion to connections with members of Congress serving on oversight committees. Dubbed cronies by critics, these civil servants perfected the art of the drawn-out investigation, demanded procedural meticulousness, and often set agendas more on the basis of how much competitors groused about a business's advertising than on sustained analysis of harm to consumers. Tellingly, the 1966 FTC Manual for Attorneys furnished detailed instructions about how to handle complaints from competing enterprises, because staff not infrequently learned about alleged violations from those quarters. By this point, the FTC had developed a reputation for fecklessness, inertia, and leniency toward powerful corporations. By contrast, at the SEC, within the Postal Inspectorate, and among the ranks of federal prosecutors, appointments and promotions more often reflected talent and performance. A few biographical sketches suggest the ability of veteran anti-fraud enforcers in these agencies to cultivate high standing among policy elites and the wider public. Irving Pollack typified the SEC's dedicated core of lawyers who hewed to meritocratic norms. Arriving at the SEC in 1946, A few years after graduation from Brooklyn Law School, Pollack was one of the few staff lawyers who had not attended an Ivy League university. Over more than three decades, he participated in almost every aspect of fraud regulation, from monitoring new issue registration statements to fraud prosecutions. As he moved into managerial positions, he created an indexing system of SEC cases to streamline the process of linking evidentiary findings to prosecutorial arguments. Because of his breadth of experience, Pollack took on a key role in conceptualizing the early 1960s special study of securities markets, a mammoth assessment of regulatory policy amid rapid changes on Wall Street. Throughout the Cold War era, the reputation established by high-ranking SEC officials such as Pollack helped the organization attract the nation's sharpest law school graduates. At the post office and justice departments, the careers of Nathaniel Kosick and Henry Montague illustrate the accrual of expertise in fraud cases. Kosick joined the fraud division in 1952 as a prosecutor after serving as an FBI agent known for excelling in the painstaking research and patient detective work which fraud cases require. He became divisional chief in 1953 and then deputy assistant attorney general in 1965. These positions afforded opportunities to plan and carry out nationwide anti-fraud campaigns, which required coordination of personnel from multiple jurisdictions and agencies. Originally a postal clerk in Poughkeepsie, New York, Montague lacked the professional education of fraud prosecutors. But after becoming a postal inspector during World War II, he received an extended tutorial on how to locate perpetrators of business frauds. After a decade of fieldwork, he became head New York inspector in 1951 and then chief postal inspector a decade later, a position that he occupied until his retirement in 1969. Montague's office was an early adopter of computer processing to improve investigators' access to mail fraud complaints and invested in forensic laboratories to speed analysis of handwriting and typewritten evidence. Throughout his tenure, he forged deep networks with other federal agencies and U.S. attorneys. By the time he left his post, exacting hiring standards and rigorous professional training had allowed the Postal Inspectorate to cultivate a reputation as among the most effective of all federal investigators. Self-regulatory organizations depended on an analogous accumulation of professional experience. Most of the key figures in the post-war BBBs were careerists. Men such as W. Dan Bell came of age in the 1920s, or the Great Depression, found a niche in the early bureaus, and stayed on for the bulk of their working lives. Beginning his BBB work by monitoring Chicago auto ads for compliance with NRA regulations, Bell worked as an automobile marketing specialist for the Cleveland BBB in the late 1930s, managed first the Peoria and then the Buffalo BBB during World War II, and took over the revived Denver Bureau in 1951, presiding over it until he retired in the mid-1970s. At the national level, Bureau leaders such as Kenneth Wilson and Victor Nyborg spent most of their adult lives with the organization. Scores of BBB officials who served during the mid-20th century had similar resumes. The professional identities of BBB leaders were based not only on the status hierarchies of a continental network of local organizations and national umbrella institutions, but also on fidelity to its mission of fostering honesty in communication with consumers and other firms. High-level BBB staff viewed themselves as deputized by the business establishment to serve as arbiters of fair competition. Kenneth Barnard summed up this self-perception in a March 1960 letter to Clyde Kemmery, then the manager of the Oklahoma City BBB. Granting that better business bureaus are the creation of the business community, Barnard refused to concede they are its vassals. Indeed, the record shows that businesses created them as the umpires of business advertising. The story was much the same at other self-regulatory bodies, such as the AMA's Department of Investigations, with the partial exception of the NASD, which into the early 1960s relied on volunteers from member firms to fulfill enforcement functions. This generation of anti-fraud specialists was influenced strongly by the Great Depression and World War II. The majority came of age during this 15-year stretch. Some served in the military. Manifesting allegiance to public service, they valued anti-fraud work as a lifelong calling. Despite close links to the business establishment, they viewed themselves as resolute defenders of the trust that underpinned capitalist marketplaces, and so the integrity and strength of the American economy. If they hungered after distinction, it was for the esteem of peers in the growing fraternity of anti-fraud investigators, prosecutors, and regulators. Like their predecessors in the Truth in Advertising movement, post-war anti-fraud regulators placed a high priority on refashioning and reinforcing social mores about manipulative and deceptive marketing. This impulse drove the many trade practice conferences convened into the 1960s by BBBs and the FTC. Republican regulators favored this mode of anti-fraud regulation because it involved minimal public expense and placed the onus for regulatory action on business. As with so many other features of the anti-fraud state, the goal of trade codes was to improve the quality of information that structured purchasing decisions. With manufacturers incorporating so many new materials, novel production processes, and other technological innovations, opportunities for misrepresentations in selling emerged all the time. The fashioning of complex service products and complicated credit terms created further avenues to mislead purchasers. Trade practice conferences gave communities of businessmen the chance to hammer out principles of fair competition that would make miscommunication, misdirection, and deception less common. The often tedious business of code-making laid out exhaustive standards for information provision. Rules articulated by the Chicago BBB in 1965 for the local advertising of plastic slipcovers convey the impulse. The slipcover code not only prohibited bait tactics, price quotes excluding labor, porous guarantees, misleading claims of low overhead, and use of asterisks or excessively small print, it also set out complex definitions for quality, at least 8th grade clear plastic with no poly or polyplastic, and specified norms for the allowable size of furniture to be covered. Tight-back, loose-cushioned sofas up to 90 inches, sections to 65 inches, and chairs approximately 34 inches in width, unless firms described variations in their ads. The thousands of marketing codes drafted from the 1940s through the mid-1960s had important implications for regulatory enforcement actions. Codes often clarified the specific nature of alleged misrepresentations. They also offered touchstones as enforcers engaged in moral suasion, because firms had participated in code formulation and had consented to the rules. The tone of BBB bulletins, for example, mixed communal boosterism with ministerial preaching that called wayward congregants back to the straight and narrow path. A 1957 bulletin from the Pittsburgh BBB to its members typified this rhetorical style. As part of a national campaign against deceptive car marketing, it had convinced over 100 area car dealerships to sign a new code of conduct. The report on this campaign for integrity in auto advertising applauded firms that had shown a vast improvement in the candor of their advertising copy and reminded dealers that they had agreed that it was more desirable to compete in a clean, competitive environment. It also contrasted the admirable dealer who didn't hem and haw when a BBB official pointed out questionable advertising claims, who was a man and so quickly agreed to run a correction, from the backsliding dealer who continued to push exaggerated price claims, the other kind of bird who tries to talk around you instead of to you, and is most interested of all in comparing himself to advantage with the dregs of other advertisers. With such messages, bureaus staked out ground as independent arbiters of best commercial practice, called on businessmen to live up to professed ideals of commercial morality, and infused those ideals with an ethos of manliness. Implicit in this framework of self-regulation was a faith in voluntary fulfillment of regulatory directives. The facilitators of trade practice conferences hoped that deliberation about the boundaries of legitimate marketing would lead participating firms to embrace the resulting standards and embed those rules in commercial routines. Insofar as the detailed rules of codes became general practice, one did not need to worry so much about compliance. Earl Kintner, a Republican FTC commissioner appointed by President Eisenhower in the late 1950s, elaborated on this approach in speeches to chambers of commerce, trade groups, advertising conventions, and BBB meetings. By every means at its disposal, Kintner explained, the commission is attempting to fan the coals of conscience into a fire hot enough to burn the impurities out of ads. Advertising agencies had to find the courage and pride to prefer professionalism to short-termism and the rat race, demonstrating that they had the guts to put these principles over billings. Media outlets should not be blinded by short-sighted visions of shady profits. Such pronouncements tinged self-regulatory endeavors with Protestant evangelism, hearkening back to the 19th-century pleas of H.H. Boardman and the moralism of progressive-era truth-in-advertising acolytes. Kintner presumed that the Bible belonged not only in the modern counting house, but also the marketing department and advertising agency. This approach to anti-fraud regulation could reconfigure competitive environments, as the FTC's moves against deceptive claims by mail-order health insurance firms illustrate. The private health insurance industry mushroomed after World War II, stimulated by wartime tax policies that made employee benefits tax-deductible, the failure of Truman's plan for public insurance, advances in medicine, and rising household incomes. Amid this surge, dozens of insurance companies looked to sell policies through the mail. By the mid-1950s, these firms provided coverage for 3 million Americans, bringing in nearly $70 million a year in premiums. Competition was fierce, encouraging expansive promises in promotional materials about benefits, which skirted exclusions, coverage limits, and policy termination triggers, though the actual policies mentioned these contractual features in fine print. As early as 1949, several larger companies had asked the FTC to sponsor a trade practice conference to root out misleading advertising tactics. The resulting meeting produced a sectoral code of conduct, but many firms refused to abide by it. Then, after a mammoth 10-month nationwide investigation in 1954 that belied its reputation for timidity, the FTC charged 41 companies with false and deceptive advertising, including several leading insurers. Through the 1945 McCarran-Ferguson Act, Congress had vested insurance regulation with the states unless they had abdicated oversight. The charged corporations used this statutory provision to challenge FTC jurisdiction in the courts. Aware that the companies had a strong case, the FTC convened a second conference to forge a revised set of industry standards, inviting not only insurers and the Health Insurance Association of America, HIAA, but also state regulators and the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, which had developed its own statement of best practices for mail-order ads. The United States Senate also began to consider legislation to tighten federal regulation of mail-order insurance marketing, as did individual states. Faced with these pressures, more established companies subscribed to a code of ethics and pledged that they would help to eliminate the bad apples in their industry. To sustain HIAA membership, companies now had to eschew misleading ad copy. Over the next several years, cut-rate mail-order insurance firms continued to pop up. But they had a harder time placing advertisements as regulators circulated lists of licensed insurers to publishers, convincing many to accept ads only from these companies. Coordinated action by BBBs could result in similar reforms. Early in the Eisenhower administration, bureaus in Los Angeles and Chicago spearheaded an initiative to clean up marketing by large discount car dealerships, which had adopted abusive sales practices such as bushing, increasing prices after an initial oral agreement, and packing, including overpriced extras in packaged car deals. In the late 1950s, nationwide cooperation among BBBs exposed systematic misrepresentation and overcharging by auto collision insurers, which in turn prompted multi-million-dollar refunds. Despite these demonstrations of the potential to reshape commercial norms through self-regulation, most post-war anti-fraud officials recognized that there would always be a population of dissemblers and swindlers who would prey on gullible Americans. As a result, every anti-fraud bureaucracy responded to budgetary constraints and procedural gauntlets by constructing internal filters to guide prosecutorial discretion. Veteran enforcement officials at the SEC and the Post Office acquired a fine-grained sense of the circumstances that facilitated successful prosecutions. Unless prosecutors saw evidence of callous deceit that would raise the hackles of judges and juries, they declined to seek indictments. The vast majority of complaints or referrals did not generate docketed investigations, while investigations leading to criminal prosecutions tended to hover at around 1%. Civil enforcement actions were more common but still represented a small fraction of official inquiries. Prosecutorial selectivity, in combination with accumulated savvy in presenting fraud cases, resulted in impressive conviction rates. From World War II through the 1960s, U.S. attorneys won criminal cases referred by the SEC more than 80% of the time. Mail fraud cases were even more likely to result in guilty verdicts. The postal inspectorate's meticulousness helped federal prosecutors to convict 19 out of 20 defendants. Such outcomes represented even greater prosecutorial successes than during the early 20th century campaigns against business fraud. Furthermore, when circumstances brought wider public attention to nodes of commercial chicanery, anti-fraud agencies had the capacity to mount coordinated campaigns with bite. In the mid-1950s, officials at the SEC and Justice Department became alarmed by boiler rooms that floated sham mining and high-tech stocks amid a booming market, as well as mutual fund managers who unloaded worthless securities on their investors. Federal regulators ramped up securities fraud investigations with annual indictments and convictions between 1959 and 1965, increasing 400% as compared to the previous 15 years. Many of these cases targeted peddlers of dodgy Canadian uranium mines or corporate shells masquerading as producers of the latest electronics wizardry. But federal prosecutors also went after more sophisticated promoters, including Walter Tellier, Lowell Burrell, and Alexander Guterma. These individuals organized complex multi-million-dollar frauds involving mergers, acquisitions, and the burgeoning corporate strategy of conglomeration. One can point to numerous enforcement drives against other arenas of business fraud. Toward the end of the 1950s, several members of Congress were alerted by constituents to an upsurge in interstate advance fee schemes, which dangled alluring franchising opportunities, promises to find buyers for those wishing to sell small businesses or residential properties, or offers to arrange loans for small business owners in need of capital. The resulting congressional hearings triggered multi-year investigations mounted by the Department of Justice's Fraud Division and the Postal Inspectorate, generating dozens of successful prosecutions. During the early 1960s, Officials at the Federal Communications Commission cooperated with their counterparts at the DOJ and the Post Office to clamp down on U.S. mail order scams that ran ads on high-powered Mexican radio stations. Throughout the 1960s, federal agencies also launched extended campaigns against credit fraud rings, interstate real estate scams, and a spate of managerial frauds at savings and loans. Even the most gung-ho enforcers, however, had to be mindful of resource constraints. Ever-present budgetary and staffing limitations allowed only so many expensive, time-consuming investigations and interagency campaigns. As a result, post-World War II anti-fraud cops, just like their interwar predecessors, relied heavily on negotiated settlements. When evidence seemed serious enough to warrant official attention, the first option was always to enter into informal discussions with a firm whose business practices were skirting the lines that separated puffery or aggressive reliance on informational advantages from fraud. Enforcement strategies at post-war BBBs typified reliance on a graduated system of sanctions. Bureau officials encouraged disgruntled purchasers to seek out resolutions such as partial refunds that would allow both sides to avoid implications of impropriety. If BBB staffers judged ads or sales techniques to violate standards of fair dealing, they would request revisions, turning to sterner measures only when businesses rebuffed these interventions. For firms that did not follow through on promises to clean up their marketing, the next stage involved drawing up formal stipulations. In April 1952, the Logan Appliance and Furniture Mart signed off on a typical voluntary agreement with the Chicago BBB, pledging to forswear advertising which has the tendency to mislead and all bait practices. They also agreed to furnish fuller information than they had about credit terms. Such declarations, like the act of signing on to an industry code, committed firms to the moral force of BBB standards and the legitimacy of ongoing BBB oversight. BBBs further asked some firms to run corrective advertisements that apologized for past deceptions. If firms rejected overtures for quiet adjustments or signed stipulations only to violate their terms, BBBs again turned to the weapon of publicity. Every local branch published newsletters calling out firms that had strayed too far from BBB principles. A still more pointed step was to give local media outlets details about a firm's repeated violations and intransigence in the face of requests for reform, and to proclaim that further advertising by this source is not in the public interest. Although not every publisher or broadcaster abided by such NIPI declarations, many, including leading publications such as the Chicago Tribune and the Los Angeles Times, did. Radio and television stations, which had to worry about FCC license renewals, also abided by bureau directives. NIPI declarations functioned like postal fraud orders, cutting lines of communication between businesses and customers. The most common outcome of such proclamations was a toning down of marketing, which led the BBB to lift its objections. According to the Chicago BBB's automotive trade consultant, Carl Dalkey, NIPIs were much more effective than to haul someone into the local state attorney's office for a hearing. What we do is not only a lot tougher, but it's faster and it works. As a result of bureau jawboning, firms ran corrections to thousands of ads, 150 in Chicago alone during 1957, and adjusted thousands more. In 1962, businesses complied with requests from the national BBB for such adjustments 93% of the time. In addition, BBB investigations could, and did, help authorities send fraudulent businessmen to jail. At the same time, BBBs emulated public anti-fraud agencies through greater concern for procedural rights. Although pushed by the consumers and competitors who complained to them, bureau officials remained representatives of the business community, eager to protect the businessman. they further had to worry about retaining membership. As a result, BBB officials extended the benefit of the doubt to established firms. The always-present threat of civil suits for conspiracy and libel fortified this inclination. From the 1930s through the mid-1960s, local BBBs faced more than 100 such lawsuits, which reinforced a preference for quiet investigation and patient persuasion. Concerns about due process eventually led BBBs to revisit the idea of an appeals process, with several local bureaus forming advertising review boards. Before a NIPI directive went into effect in these markets, an affected enterprise could ask for a hearing before a tribunal of prominent BBB members. After sustained debate within national BBB structures, the organization endorsed such forums in late 1952. By the end of 1960, 26 BBBs had one, with a further 16 in the works. The extension of proceduralism into self-regulation created openings for business cheats in much the same fashion as had the punctiliousness of FTC cease and desist hearings. Consider the saga of Fritzl Television Repair. For almost two decades, owners of televisions and radios complained to the Chicago local BBB about Fritzl, alleging unauthorized, unnecessary, and faked repairs, shoddy work, overcharges, and rank coercion, as employees refused to return radio or television sets until bills were paid in full, regardless of pending complaints. Fritzl customers pleaded with the BBB to make the firm accountable for its abuses and to warn others about it. "I keep wondering," a Mrs. André Chervance wrote in June 1954, "how many other people are being done in as I was. I don't like to feel that such dishonesty can go unchecked." Into the 1960s, bureau staff regularly contacted the company to mediate on behalf of consumers like this Northside housewife. Fritzl accommodated BBB overtures, reaching numerous settlements with disgruntled customers, but not changing its business practices. Only after the Illinois Bureau of Consumer Fraud began a 1964 investigation did the BBB go after the firm, assisting with a sting operation that demonstrated a pattern of fake repairs in which Fritzl technicians replaced working components with second-rate or even faulty ones. Here was another Holland Furnace Company, operating on a local scale. Cases like Fritzl recur throughout the Chicago BBB files. Although complaint mediation frequently happened within days, BBBs often took years to adopt tougher measures, especially when businesses did not make the mistake of brushing off BBB staff. Even a steady stream of mediated compromises, ad corrections, and stipulations might not lead to less deceptive marketing. As with FTC disciplinary action, a far-sighted marketing department could easily cope with BBB finger-wagging. By the time that a BBB staffer objected to an ad, firms could cheerfully comply because they were about to roll out a different, though analogous, pitch. BBB methods did not necessarily work better than those of the administrative state. Beginning in the late 1950s, some BBBs tried a more preventive tack by offering advance assessments of advertising campaigns. The vetting of proposed ads allowed businesses to receive clearer signals about the interpretive boundaries of BBB and media codes of conduct. This opportunity to iron out wrinkles before the fact, bureau officials insisted, did not constitute pre-censorship. It was merely a sensible mechanism to ward off deceptive pitches before they reached the public's ears and eyes. On occasion, persistent preaching led to conversion. The post-war Chicago BBB could point to numerous examples in which years of jawboning persuaded an aggressive discount house to clean up its advertising. Bargaintown USA, for instance, tussled with the head of the bureau's home furnishings division for nearly 5 years in the late 1950s and early 1960s. On several occasions, BBB officials demanded ad corrections by this local toy store chain. Three times they issued three NIPI directives because of disputed comparative price claims. Bargetown treated BBB officials with deference and complied with these requests. Eventually, its owner-managers also agreed to cease making claims about markdowns from manufacturers' suggested list prices on the grounds that the ongoing revolution in American distribution had so intensified price competition as to render them meaningless and confusing, producing a lack of confidence by the consumer in ourselves as merchants and in the toy industry in general. BBB officials could not hope for a clearer recitation of the truth in advertising catechism. From the 1920s up to the late 1960s, the FTC, SEC, and Post Office disposed of its fraud-related caseload in similar fashion. If inquiries convinced FTC lawyers that a firm's marketing promotions had the capacity to mislead, they looked to negotiate pledges to stop the offending practices. In order to encourage compromises, the FTC in 1951 stopped requiring that businesses agree to findings of illegal marketing as a condition of stipulations. Beginning in 1962, it followed the BBB's lead and set up an advisory service to dispense guidance about the legitimacy of new marketing strategies. SEC and postal regulators likewise looked to give firms the chance to correct problems before initiating the creaky wheels of formal legal process. If registration documents for an initial public offering lacked important details or included misleading text, SEC officials would send a deficiency letter that laid out the problematic features and asked for revisions. After a process of give and take by conferences, telegraph messages, telephone conversations, or correspondence, the Commission would draft a voluntary agreement setting out necessary amendments. SEC staffers also issued advisory opinions to corporate lawyers who asked for guidance about the legality of promotional materials. Within the Post Office, most fraud investigations led not to fraud orders or indictments, but rather stipulations in which firms promised to discontinue objectionable marketing. This posture reflected realities that confront all regulatory bureaucracies. But for BBBs and many officials at federal anti-fraud agencies, they also represented deeper philosophical commitments amid the era's epical conflicts with Soviet communism. BBB leaders remained dedicated to an ideology of business self-regulation, in which regulators, ideally, handled marketing deceptions outside the glare of publicity. This style also suited the leadership of the post-war FTC and SEC. Convinced that most businessmen were trustworthy and well-meaning, these officials gave reputable firms considerable leeway. There would be, Earl Kintner and later Democratic FTC Chair Paul Rand Dixon agreed, no commercial Gestapo as the United States engaged in the battle between individual freedom and state slavery. The sentiments expressed by these two FTC commissioners spoke to broader impulses that underpinned anti-fraud policies from the early New Deal through the first years of the Kennedy administration. During these three decades, most new anti-fraud regulations and enforcement campaigns were pushed either by business interests or policy entrepreneurs within anti-fraud agencies. Corporate interests, such as textile manufacturers, worked to root out what they saw as unfair competition. Policymakers sometimes worried about systemic threats that fraud posed to capitalist markets, nowhere more so than in securities regulation, as the Great Depression left an enduring imprint. In other contexts, such as the post-World War II moves against diploma mills, legislators and regulators looked to protect the government itself, much as the Reconstruction-era Post Office had moved against mail fraud to safeguard its own reputation. These efforts were often inflected by deeper faith in the value of candor in commercial speech. They always depended on dense networks that linked national and state governments with self-regulatory organizations. In all of these contexts, Anti-fraud regulators stressed the importance of looking out for consumers and investors who lacked the information or sophistication to sidestep misleading and fraudulent pitches. But before the 1960s, consumer perspectives rarely drove either anti-fraud politics or policy. In the 1940s and 1950s, organizations such as Consumers Research and Consumers Union did help educate Americans about marketing deceptions, but they lacked the bureaucratic capacity, strategic vision, and standing to set regulatory agendas. Amid the heightened socioeconomic expectations that accompanied the post-war boom, however, a resurgent consumer movement would increasingly bring its own analyses of business fraud to Washington, D.C., state capitol buildings, and city council chambers. Buoyed by the more general political activism of the 1960s and greater awareness that specific demographic groups continued to be the victims of abusive marketing practices, advocates of consumerism would soon inject a new sense of urgency into public efforts to beat back the scourge of business fraud.